You can talk a little more?
Testing. Check. 1, 2, 3. 1, 2. The big brown fox jumped over the lazy dog. It was gray. I should have noticed.
Nobody says that anymore, but that's a
quick
typing.
Brown fox.
It's a typing thing.
It is.
It's not for a sound check.
But it's a phrase. Yeah, like I could go, Peter Piper picked a peck of pickled peppers.
You can't say
it. If I was checking. What's that?
You couldn't even say it.
Yeah.
My grandfather used to like three smart fellas. They felt smart.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, turn off that phone. Hello, everybody.
Sorry, it's silent. But.
Out there in podcast land. Welcome to Comedy Death Star, the podcast that digs into the dark side of comedy. I'm your host, Denzel Myers. Our guest this week is Bill Cott. Spent 5 years on The Wizards of Waverly Place, Disney Channel, Dude, Where's My Car? I love that movie. Galaxy Quest. I just saw that recently, and it was so hilarious, I immediately watched it again.
Oh, wow.
And a bunch of other places on your TV dial, you'll probably recognize Bill. In the next hour, we'll find out if Bill is indeed a living person, as claimed on his Wikipedia page. But first, a message from our corporate overlords. Comedy Death Star is a production of Actors Comedy Studio and ACSDigital.tv. I'm Denzel Myers. Our guest today is actor, comedian, and improviser, Bill Cott. How you doing?
Good. How about yourself?
Good.
So it says on my Wikipedia page that I am a real-life person?
A living person.
A living person.
You know, they say...
Oh, okay. So they always say... Oh, so you can check it immediately, know whether they're alive or dead.
Exactly.
I see. So it's everybody's Wikipedia page that says that.
Well, not Einstein.
You got a good point there.
He's a deceased person.
I guess I'm no Einstein.
You're no Einstein. I'm probably not the first person that has pointed that out to you.
No. I think my dad was the first.
To point out that you're no Einstein.
Yeah.
All right. I just want to ask about your name. So, yeah, you're tragically misunderstood. It's C-H-O-T-T.
Yeah, it's been pronounced chot, choat, shot, shoat. My dad used to say every time somebody would say shot, he'd say, yep, I'm the big shot. He's the little shot.
Not Einstein. Yeah. Do you know where's it from?
It's from Bohemia, technically.
Okay.
Because that was at a time when,
Czechoslovakia.
So it's Czech, Slovak, a little bit of Germany, a little bit of Poland.
Yeah.
It was all so one odd region.
Bohemian.
Yeah, so right, it's cool. People ask me, what's my heritage? I say, I'm Bohemian. And they're like, okay, but where's your family from? And I'm like, go figure it out.
Bohemia.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's the original Bohemians.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Now, I want to ask, you've been on This Is Us.
Yes.
Right, which is a new series. It's coming up on its second season.
Yeah, they got renewed in advance for 2 more seasons.
Yeah.
And they just cleaned up at the Emmy nominations,
so hopefully they'll
clean up at the Emmys, too.
And now, the thing is, you were a mailman on that show. You had a small part, a co-star, right? Barely get a credit. But you've had some really surprising fan reactions. What happened?
It was tremendous. Well, you know, I do a lot of these roles where I do like a walk-on, and I'm, you know, the mailman, the TV repairman, something like that.
Yeah, I was going to introduce you as the most famous guy that you say, I've seen that guy somewhere before, but I have no idea who he is. That's you.
So hopefully people will be scrambling to my IMDb page to figure that out.
You've made a career out of being like, who the hell is that guy?
Exactly.
Congratulations.
So I just assumed it was another one of those roles where, you know, I'm there to serve the main characters. And even though my audition had a little more gravitas to it, I went in there and my first read for them was very... You know, mild, very, not, I wouldn't say disconnected, but certainly more focused on Sterling Brown's reactions and, you know, trying to feed what he was doing.
Yeah, you're just a mailman.
Yeah. And he even requested that, you know, from somebody else that I'd be given a little more room and a little more latitude. And the director came forth and talked with me a little bit about that and said, you know, let's bring more of what you did in the audition. I was like, okay. But you never know which take they're going to wind up using. And so I was sitting on the couch with my family watching it. And all of a sudden, my Twitter and my Facebook starts blowing up because people were commenting on it and, like, celebrities were mentioning it and tagging it. And everybody was talking about how the mailman made them cry. And so, yeah.
Made you cry.
Yeah. I made a bunch of folks cry. I'm used to making people laugh. And for this one time, I made a lot of people cry.
So the mailman, did you know when you did the part, like, that there was that feeling? Did you think, oh, people are going to cry at this moment? Probably not, right?
I didn't know. When I auditioned for the role, they didn't mention, and you know, in case anybody has not yet watched my episode, which is, I think, episode 17, season 1. Turn it down or fast forward until you watch that episode. But
spoiler.
That the character, exactly, because some people worry about spoilers a half a year later.
Wow.
You'd be surprised. that the character of William was dead. In the audition, they just said that William was upstairs resting. And then they told me in the audition that his character died. And I had just kind of like absorbed myself with the show when I was doing research for it. And so I kind of like naturally cried. I didn't have to go through any process whatsoever to start tearing up. Plus, it was also the actor's thing of, oh no, they've thrown another thing at me that's really tough to handle. So it was also partially a natural reaction.
So you started to cry.
Yeah. And like I said, I didn't know they were going to use that tank or which tank they would use. Yeah. And
so just in the audition they told you that he was dead or not in the performance?
Oh, not in the performance. That would have been hell to find out that day.
Some directors
But I'm sure,
that.
Oh, yeah.
Their scripts change and, yeah.
Yeah. So so I just found out at the audition. And then when I went in for the performance, you know, I, you know, like I said, I kind of gradually did a bunch of takes, which were increasingly more emotional. And I thought the one that they used might have been too over the top because then it makes a lot of focus on the mailman when it's supposed to be on Sterling Brown's character. So
that's why they have you do it a bunch of times. They don't know exactly what fits. And so people, a bunch of people cried. Everybody's talking about it.
Yeah.
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 That's good. Yeah. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
That's awesome. All right. Let's, I'm going to change the subject altogether.
Sure.
What kind of cartoons did you watch when you were a kid on TV? You seem like a cartoon kid.
Definitely. Yeah. I don't know how you gleaned that because I don't post a lot about cartoons on social media.
I haven't seen you post anything.
But yeah, so
I never asked that question before. But for
interesting,
you,
cool. So I guess I do look cartoonish.
Jesus.
I watched all the Warner Brothers cartoons. Me and my brother and my sister would watch the whole Bugs Bunny and Friends every Saturday, and then just the old Warner Brothers cartoons after school. Now, when we moved to Detroit, Michigan.
From Missouri.
Yes.
Yeah.
When we moved to Detroit, Michigan, they didn't play a lot of the Warner Brothers cartoons because the local station there played a lot of the Universal cartoons.
Okay.
So for the first time, I was introduced to Woody Woodpecker and Chilly Willy the Penguin and all those characters. So
I like Chilly Willy.
I did too.
I forgot about Chilly Willy.
And Droopy.
Droopy Dog.
Droopy Dog.
Yeah. And any one of those, do you have a favorite? So do you kind of identify, like, this was the one for me? Doesn't sound like it.
Yeah. I love all of them. I really loved Bugs Bunny and his, like, I always thought that Mickey Mouse, and this is no insult to the Disney family, whom I love so much.
Disney family.
But it always seemed so sterile, you know, and ha-ha, look what silly thing just happened. And Bugs was just about anarchy and chaos.
Yeah.
And so I really identified with that.
I think that Mickey Mouse and that was made for kids.
Yeah.
But Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck, that was made for grown-ups.
It was,
right?
Definitely.
I mean,
well, the early Mickey Mouse, I listened to the whole biography, one of them, one of several, about Walt Disney. And Mickey used to be a lot more naughty, a lot more, I don't want to say sexual, but at least,
mischievous.
Insinuative.
Yes.
And all that dropped off once they realized, oh, we can corner the market on kids' entertainment. Yeah. So
I think once the 50s really got rolling,
they
cleaned it up.
Yeah.
They cleaned it up a lot. Yeah. Now I want to ask about your place. It's called the Improv Trick.
Yes.
And you have classes there, improv shows.
We started in 2005, and we started because I was traveling a lot working for the Second City and working for my friend Al Samuel's company, Spark Creative, teaching corporate workshops. And my ex-wife, who's still a great person. But
how many of those
do
you have?
Just one ex-wife.
Okay. All right, that's good.
One potential ex-wife right now. We love one another, and we just had a little baby.
Yeah.
But she was wondering, why do you have to travel all over to teach improv? I said, well, I would have to start my own classes here in town, and that would be a big burden. And don't get me wrong, it is. But I figured, okay, I'll give it a shot. And so as soon as I decided I wanted to, my friend Becky LaFord knew some friends who had a coffee shop. And he was opening it up and was renting it out for very affordable prices. It was something like $10 an hour to be able to have classes there and
it's
do
coffee
shows.
Coffee shop, I mean, you know, an extra $10.
And they had a beautiful outside, like, beer garden sort of area. So we did our classes and our shows out there. Luckily, it wasn't during any sort of inclement weather. And since then we've gone from one location to another looking for a semi-permanent home, and the closest to that we found is the White Fire Theater in Sherman Oaks, and then we just opened another location back in Pasadena where we had started doing classes in, I think, 2010 in Pasadena, And a little while ago, we had lost the place we were doing classes at, and we had been looking and looking, and finally we found a place called the Tutu School where they teach ballet classes for young children during the day. And then at night, obviously, they're not doing anything else. So I'm renting it out from this lovely woman, Charlene.
The Tutu, what is it called? Tutu Palace?
The Tutu School. It'd be nice if it was the Tutu Palace.
Tutu Center, Tutu Palace.
Come by the Tutu Palace.
Tutu Palace.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it does.
We're Tutu committed.
And the people that take the classes, is it all actors? Is it all
entertainment company people? I would say not. I would say it's primarily people who want to improve their communication skills. It's people who want to, you know, just out of curiosity, learn a little bit about improv, or because improv is their comedy or their hobby. Yeah, yeah, there are a few actors, you know, but I guess for Pasadena, a lot of actors might take the classes because it's a little bit closer than driving all the way into Hollywood. Sure. But for some people, if they're actors, they realize, and it's true, and it's not what we offer there in Pasadena, that it's not the world's best showcase for, you know, if you want to become a professional actor. Yeah. So
and there are programs that are going to do that particular thing.
Absolutely, and they do it a lot better than I ever could.
Do you have some writers, directors, or is it mostly civilians?
And directors, too, but a lot of civilians. Yeah, we've had people who are, because it's so close to Fuller Seminary, we've had a lot of seminarians come. And a lot of them are there because they want to be better public speakers. But there was my most successful student from that program, a guy named Jeff Verry, or the Reverend Jeff Verry now, was taking classes because he wanted to improve his listening skills because he was going to be working with people in hospice.
Wow.
And people who've worked with him said he's one of the best listeners they've ever had.
So that's a great opening for me, right? The theological seminary is sending people over to improv classes. So he wanted to become a better listener.
Yeah.
And it evidently worked. Yeah. They want to tell some jokes as theological students.
Exactly. Yeah.
People think it is always about jokes. Mm-hmm. But if you're doing this kind of work and you do corporate work, it's really other stuff going on.
Definitely.
It's not improv equals joke.
Yeah. Which is a common misconception. I'm sure you run up into a bunch.
So like they're not priests necessarily, but you know, they're on that track.
Yeah.
And other people, corporate people, what do they get out of this? What's like for a corporate group, what do they walk away from at the end of the day? Or, you know, what are your hopes going to happen for them?
I think they learn a lot of lessons, like obviously the teamwork and team building aspect of it all.
Okay.
But listening a lot deeper and listening to fully listen instead of listen to respond. Because a lot of us are, you know, out there listening, halfway formulating our response while the other person's talking. And I think listening helps so much more in sales, because instead of just coming out there with this format of how I'm going to sell and what I'm going to sell, find out what the person really needs, because that's the job of a salesman, is to really understand their client.
I have been working 30 years in marketing and advertising.
Mm-hmm.
That's my side job, so I'm not a starving actor. I do that. And everybody thinks that marketing means having something to say.
Yeah.
But the first step is to listen.
Yeah, start a conversation.
Yeah.
And that's how we met.
Everybody wants to skip the first step
of
listening, just to go right to what you have to say. And the team building, I've heard what you said. It's good for team building.
Mm-hmm.
But for people that have no idea what the heck you're talking about, how does an improv class help a group of people, like an accounting department,
mm-hmm.
right? How does that help them be a better team?
Well, I think the number one component of a good team is trust and acceptance. And that's the first thing we teach them. There's an exercise I love to do called Yes. I'm sure you're familiar with that one, where people are standing in a circle and they point at another person and they can't move until the other person says yes. And then they walk across the circle, take their place in the circle, and the next person has to do the same thing.
Right.
And everybody thinks they understand the exercise when I explain it, but their ego tells them, I can walk across a circle without someone's permission. And so that one tends to like break people down really quick and say like, oh, I think I understand the spirit of acceptance and trust, but I'm not putting it into practice.
Yeah.
So I think that kind of snaps people in really quick.
That exercise also, if I get it correct, I look at you. We make eye contact.
Yeah, as a matter.
And then you have to say yes. So there's two parts. I have to actually meet you.
There has to be a connection.
And receive something, and then I can move to your place. And you do. And it's we want to skip all those parts.
Yeah,
we want to. They're so simple. So I agree with you. A lot of times the process just slows stuff down that we normally do so quickly, and we don't even think about it.
Right.
And it's fun. So,
and I think once you can trust somebody, you can start taking action knowing they'll be supportive of it instead of hoping they'll be supportive of
hope,
it.
Now, I want to ask a quick question. Are you still doing that work that you were doing a while ago with the child athletes where you heckle them? Because that is a real great service to heckle young athletes. But are you still doing that work? Are you retired?
Thank you. No, obviously you're talking about the video that I did with Brian Kahn where I was a character who was heckling child athletes.
Yeah.
It was a friend of mine. He was trying to get a job at ESPN doing comedy.
Oh, I want to hear about the heckling of the
and
kids.
So, okay, well, in the video, I stand there and God, it's been years since I saw it. And it was a short film, so I'm not sure if I remember any of the lines from it.
Just go with it, Bill. Stop making excuses.
He would just hang out at the a little league game shouting, "Hey, batter, 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 swing, batter!" And then watching a kid play tennis saying, "Hey, you know what you have in common with Pete Sampras? The ass part." Things like that.
Heckling young athletes
to make them stronger so that maybe they won't react violently when they're heckled.
That's right, to make them stronger. See, this is the part I mean, anybody can heckle. Anybody can heckle kids. It's even easier because they're defenseless
they
and
don't
their
know
parents
how to come
aren't
back
around.
With it.
But you are doing it to help them as a service.
Yeah.
Right?
Right. It was from the bottom of my heart.
Yeah, heckling can be disruptive. It can mess you up, get in your head.
Yeah.
And if you have a moment... Right, that was your story. You had a moment.
Yeah, he was a professional ice skater.
That's right.
He threw the girl up in the air, and somebody heckled. He turned, and she fell down on the ice.
He said, "Hey, Butterfingers, don't drop her."
That's right.
And
wow,
he dropped her.
Wow, you really do your research.
And so you devoted your life to helping young people never have that moment where the chips are down and the heckler can get under your skin.
Yes.
Well, that's really nice, Bill.
Well, thank you. I'm glad.
Yeah. that's just what that's for.
I get points every time that happens?
I get points. Oh. You're allowed to ring the bell.
Am I?
Yeah.
Order up.
That's the reason. Because, you know, if you go to one of those establishments where they have a bell at the counter and the server is right there, and you look at the guy and you say, "Hey, can I ring the bell?" The look of anguish on their face.
Really?
Because they never want you to ring the goddamn bell. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll tell you what. When we did shows and classes in Pasadena originally, it was at Hutch's Barbecue, which was a great old barbecue shack. And they had a bell like that at the front for when an order was up or when somebody needed to have their order taken. Well, unfortunately, we would play a lot of games like New Choice, which involved the bell. It would freak out the kitchen staff when they'd hear that bell and they'd think there was an order coming in or there was an order up.
I love it. Yeah. Now I'm getting offers from both sides, you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
Like next, you know, New Choice, bing, and the plate of ribs shows up.
Exactly.
Know? Or the opposite.
Yeah. Pulled pork fries.
Boom, you know.
Oh, mother, why?
Yeah, all right. I like it. And now we've rang the bell about 8 times, which is good. I'd like to get it in there. I heard that you also do magic.
Yes, I do. Matter of fact, I'm doing magic this weekend, which is my birthday, July 23rd, at Christ the King Catholic Church. They're doing a fundraiser and Sloppy Joe picnic.
The Catholic Church has a long history of doing magic on stage, you know what I'm saying?
That's very true.
Eucharist thing.
Well, that's where I think the phrase hocus pocus comes from.
Catholic Church?
Yeah, yeah. It was an interpretation of the phrase like hokum porci or something like that. Some Latin phrase. It could be wrong. Maybe it's another magic phrase that we hear all the time.
Yeah.
But it was something that they heard during the transubstantiation for communion. And so people heard that and thought that was some magic words. And so magicians started saying hocus pocus.
Is your family Catholic?
I was raised Catholic. Yeah, I was baptized Catholic. Okay. And then my father became an Orthodox Catholic priest. Which was he had studied to become a Roman Catholic priest before he met my mom.
When your mom
and then
got
that
pregnant,
changed.
Yeah.
It was well before that. I still believe they kept their virginity until marriage.
This is the entertainment world. We can compress time here. We have that
freedom.
All right,
let's do that. It makes it sexier.
License. Yes. Well, it's more scandalous that he was.
And then later, my father he fell away from the church and wrote a book about. It's called Inside God's Head. and it was about his experiences. Not so much a joke book, but definitely funny.
Okay.
In parts, and definitely tragic in others.
Uh-huh. Oh, practical joke book.
Yes, exactly. Extremely practical.
God's got to be a practical joker, you know?
Yeah.
All those people are like, why does evil exist in the world? Because this dude is fucking with your head. This is fucking with you, man.
My dad's theory was that God had the best sense of humor.
I like it.
Yeah.
I like it. I only asked about the Catholicism because I was going to ask you to explain what is the transubstantiation.
Yeah, that's when the...
Please pronounce it properly.
Transubstantiation.
Yeah, explain what that
is. That is when the bread and wine become the body and blood of Christ, if you believe that that happens.
Nothing up my sleeve. Watch me. Hey, Rocky, watch me pull a rabbit out of my hat.
Must have been the wrong Christ.
Again? Yeah. Rocky and Bullwinkle. All right, so magic, do you tap dance? I mean, how many other talents do you have?
I wish I could tap dance.
Okay.
I do magic. I sing.
Yep.
I won a Broadway World Award for my portrayal of Fred Mertz in I Love Lucy Live on Stage, the musical, which is the reason I'm going to be going to the Lucille Ball Comedy Festival, the Lucy Fest in Jamestown, New York.
You mentioned that when you first came in, and I said, don't tell me anymore,
right.
la, I don't know, but... Jamestown, New York.
Yes, Jamestown, New York.
Lucille Ball.
That was Lucille
Comedy
Ball's
Festival.
Hometown.
That's her hometown.
Jamestown. And she started show business there and then decided, all right, I'm going to New York, and then started working in radio and film, and then she worked in Hollywood for a while, and then I Love Lucy happened. So
when did she start? Because early.
Oh, yeah. She was like, it was in the... late 30s, would think.
Yeah, I think it must have been that early.
Yeah, because she had done a lot of stuff where she was like the femme fatale, you know. And then the movie Du Barry Was a Lady with Red Skelton, two redheads in the same film.
Red Skelton was amazing.
Yeah.
You know, he was a painter?
Yes, I did know that.
He painted a lot of portraits, a lot of self-portraits of clowns,
mm-hmm.
of his own creations.
Yeah.
And I was doing some work one time. I went to somebody's house. It was just like some normal average people.
Mm-hmm.
And they had about 12 or 15 of Red Skelton's own paintings. You know, they're kind of small, like 8 by 10.
But you can imagine how many he must have done.
They bought them over the years. Yeah, I don't think they were expensive. But
right.
they were real Red Skelton originals in their house. So this thing, when does this happen? The Lucille Ball Comedy Festival.
It happens the 5th through the 8th. In Jamestown, New York, of August.
Of
so
August.
It's coming right up.
August, okay.
Next weekend, I will be there, I think.
Two weekends.
Yeah.
And what happens? Do they show movies? Do they...
Well, what they do is...
Kill rubber chickens?
There are trivia contests. Yeah. That's where the Lucy Desi Museum is, where a recreation of the I Love Lucy set is. And people who are visitors only that weekend can get their pictures taken. That's the only time they
on
allow
the
people
set.
To take... have take pictures taken on the set of I Love Lucy.
Wow.
All kinds of vintage costumes and film equipment, because you know it was the second, people think it was the first, but it was the second television show to be captured as a three camera shoot in front of a live audience that way.
What was the first?
The first was Amos and Andy.
Really?
Yeah.
I knew this was one of the originals.
Part of the history got swept under the carpet. Matter of fact, the reason they allowed to do it, because Lucy wanted to do it from Los Angeles, not New York.
Right.
So, because she wanted her whole family to be together. And so...
And that was new. That had never been done.
Yeah.
Yeah, for a show.
So, Jess Oppenheimer, who was the original executive producer, said, listen, it's being done right now. It's being shot. Amos and Andy, which at that time, you know, now we look back on it and say, you know, it's a painful part of... the racist history of America
and
of the media. Yeah.
Yeah.
But at the time, it was the number one. It had been going on since like the 20s. On the radio.
Yeah.
And, you know, it reinforced a lot of negative stereotypes, it also, I think, made people feel a little bit more like, hey, maybe there is something that brings us all together.
Yeah.
Even if these are white guys. You know, doing embarrassing.
Well, yeah, there were white guys in blackface.
You know what? They never. And this is a misconception about that show. They were never in blackface.
They
doing
were never.
That. There was one promotional picture
on
taken
on the radio. They
yeah,
were never in blackface.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And there was actual African American, and that's why it's pretty significant.
Yeah.
That Amos and Andy was the first three camera shoot. Is that was an actual African American cast in the television show?
Yeah.
But on the radio show, there was one promotional picture where they said, can you pretend like you're putting on the blackface? And these guys were like, I don't know, because what they did really wasn't like a minstrel show.
No.
They didn't, you know.
Like a vaudeville
I don't think
minstrel
it was
show.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't that.
Which was incredibly, like even 20 times more offensive than what they were doing.
Well, but at the time, that was accepted.
Yeah.
Yeah. But so Amos and Andy is a radio show.
Yes.
And there's two white guys playing black guys.
Yeah. Stuff. It was basically like the Honeymooners. It was two guys who always had these get-rich-quick schemes. One guy was the overbearing guy. The other guy was just like at his own pace, and I'll do whatever you say sort of thing.
Yeah. That format, those two guys together, the Honeymooner format, that's been going on forever.
Yeah, Two Broke Girls.
Yeah,
right?
Two Broke Girls. I mean, any kind of – the Flintstones is exactly that show.
Oh, yeah. It's just cut and pasted and put in cartoon form.
Last summer I was on the East Coast. I was visiting some family, and the Honeymooners was on.
Mm-hmm.
And they were in a pool hall, and, you know – Jackie Gleason was trying to shoot some billiards, and anytime he would do it, Ed would have something to say. But then Norton leaves, and Ralph says to some other guy, he says, if that guy wasn't my best friend, I would have nothing to do with him. And I said, this is basically it. Like, you take that phrase and what's built into that relationship, and you just use it over and over and over again. Even Rick and Morty cartoon is the same kind of thing. There's one guy that seems to know it all, and the other guy that just goes along with it, and it never works out the way they want it.
Yep.
Ever. That and the husband, like the guy who's head of his family, head of the castle.
Yeah, who has no control over anything.
The Honeymooners, that part too. Right?
Yeah,
and that
totally
goes, obviously, Married with Children and every sitcom we have now, right?
They're all hapless fathers. There's never like a strong, domineering, supportive guy who really knows it all. They tried to with Father Knows Best, and it succeeded, but it really wasn't a comedy.
It wasn't a comedy.
Yeah.
Well, because the guy who's the head, the king of the castle, the head of the household, if he has all the status, power, and influence that comes with that position, it's a drama.
Exactly.
If he has none of the status and influence of that position, it's a comedy. So he's got to be the biggest boob in the household because he's the one who's supposed to be in charge.
Yep.
And he has an impossibly hot younger wife. I mean, that's...
That always helps.
Yeah, anyway. I wanted to ask one more question about your thing, the improv trick. Is there a trick?
Yeah, there is.
What is the trick? I mean, yeah.
I'm sure it's going to be no revelation to you, but the way I phrase it to people is, well, first of all, when I was a kid, before I discovered improv, magic was my way to reach out to people.
Oh, right.
I was always the new kid. We moved from St. Louis, Missouri, to right outside of Houston, Texas, then back to St. Louis, then to Detroit, Michigan, then back to St. Louis. We moved twice within Detroit. We originally lived on 9 Mile, and then we lived Sterling Heights.
Was your dad in the mob? He was in a witness protection program after the priesthood. They were coming after the Italians. They were coming after him.
No, he used to write industrial shows. As a matter of fact, he was one of the earliest people to incorporate Second City's cast into corporate shows that he was writing in Chicago.
Okay.
And so he would go all over the country, you know, being hired for contract for one company or another. So it was almost like being brought up a military brat or a PK, or a priest kid, or preacher's kid. There aren't many priest kids unless they're Orthodox.
There are actually a lot of them. We just don't talk about
it. And so magic was the way I'd reach out to people.
All right. Pick a card.
Exactly.
Got it.
The thing about magic and improv and there's a bunch of other similarities, but the main similarity is when you do a magic trick for somebody, you're making it all about them.
Yes.
You're making it, you're making them your focus. This is happening for them. And you're making believe for their benefit this is the first time it's ever happened or that it's unusual that it happens in front of them. Mm. And improv does the same thing. You put all your focus on the other person. It's all about them. It's about that moment and making that moment special and for them. That's the trick. When people ask me what the trick is, it's about making it about the other person.
Well, I never heard it put that way. But now that you say it, I get it. And I like that. I like the metaphor or analogy. It's an analogy because it's direct. And it's happening for us for the first time here, right now.
Exactly.
That's a great quality. All right, so there is a trick. Good. Now how old were you when you first ran away from home?
I was 2 years old. I had just learned to walk. I threw a bindle over my shoulder tied to a yardstick.
Really?
No, I think
you should have just gone with it, Bill.
I forgot I'm supposed to say yes and on this podcast.
You're an improviser.
Where did that question come from? When was the first time I ran away from home? I'm curious.
Who's asking the questions here?
I'm curious because you've done some really good research, and I'm wondering if that's based on something that was put online about me.
No.
All right.
I like to ask this question because most people have an answer.
Okay. So the actual answer was, and that's what was inspired by the yardstick with the bindle, was that when I was 5 years old, we lived on Baso Court in St. Louis, right outside of St. Louis. And there was a creek behind the house across the street from us that led, the creek would lead all the way through the woods. And we would occasionally go into the woods and play in the woods and play in the creek, even though my mom said, don't go near the creek. You can go in the woods, but don't go near the creek. And
of
so,
course you go in the creek, yeah.
Of course, because but the reason she said not to is there were like there were copperhead snakes there and cottonmouths, and so we were not supposed to go anywhere near it. And we did and never saw one of those snakes.
Right.
But so I decided, yeah, I'm gonna strike out into the woods and make it on my own. And then, of course, I got a little while in, and it started to get dark. And luckily, before it got too dark, I walked back.
At age 5 or so?
Oh, I think it was. Maybe I was a little bit older than 5, but I know it was. We only lived in that home from age 5 until, I think, 8.
Do you remember what prompted you to strike out on your own?
Not at all.
Were you upset, or you just said, "Hey, I'm
probably
gonna
just
away.
Independence," or maybe I had just seen somebody who on TV who had like the bindle. I'll bet it was Little Rascals.
Oh, right.
Because they would do stuff like that. They would decide they're running away from home and pack a bindle.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, and you wanted to be more like Stymie.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
Or maybe Spanky.
Or Spanky.
Yeah.
All right, but that's interesting. You didn't.
Stymie was my favorite, though. It's interesting you bring that up.
Why Stymie?
I don't know why. Maybe because he had a bowler, and I love bowler hats.
Nothing like a kid.
But he
bowler.
Seemed the most natural, you know?
I mean, uncontrived.
Yeah.
An uncarved block.
Yeah, he was kind of like calm. The other kids were kind of like, hey, we're all talking like this.
Yeah.
And Stymie'd be like, I don't know about you guys, you know?
Feet don't fail me now. Yeah, that's funny. I like that, nothing wrong happened that you remember. You just decided it was time to, you know, have an adventure.
Yeah.
Yeah, all right. Now, as a child, you had an imaginary friend. Yeah?
I didn't.
No?
I'm one of the few kids who didn't. And I understand, you know, people who have an active imagination usually do have an imaginary friend. I don't recall ever having an imaginary friend. I don't recall my mom ever mentioning me having had an imaginary friend.
You had to ask your mom if you could have an imaginary friend?
She probably wouldn't let me.
Somebody gave
you like, I want to meet this so-called imaginary friend.
Do you have brothers and sisters?
Yes, I have an older sister and a younger brother.
All right, happy
we're
family,
we're all separated
happy
by 3 years. I would say so.
All right, maybe that's why you didn't.
We were especially tight just because we moved around so often that our tight unit of friends was us, the three of us.
Okay.
Yeah.
So maybe
on This Is Us, they call them the brothers and sisters, the big three, which was pretty much what we were. My sister was adopted.
Okay.
Because my parents didn't know that they could have kids. They tried and... Mm-hmm. And then they realized, oh, wait a minute, that's what the church was keeping from us. And then...
Wait, I know how to do this. Wait, no. You're doing it all wrong.
They had been praying for the stork to bring someone.
Yeah.
But they found out by surprise 3 years after they adopted my sister that they could have kids. And so I came by 3 years later, and then my brother came 3 years after that. So we're all separated by 3 years.
All right. So it still took them 3 years to make the connection. I mean, they
yes.
found out that it was possible, and then something just took 3 years for it to. Now, you mentioned waiting for the stork to come by.
Yes.
I ran across a joke in an old joke book a couple of weeks ago, and I don't get it. And let me tell you the joke, basically, and maybe you'll get it. Three storks meet at the corner bar at the end of a long day.
Mm-hmm.
And they're all, you know, kind of exhausted. And the first one, they were like, how was your day? And the first one said, oh, I had a hell of a day. I had 5 individual deliveries in 5 different cities. You know, I had to put on all these miles. Boom. The second Stark said, well, that's nothing. I had 2 sets of twins and then a set of triplets. And, you know, I'm exhausted. And they said to the third one, how was it for you? And he said, not too good. All I got to do was scare the hell out of a couple of stenographers. And I don't really get it.
Neither do I. It sounds like, You know, like all those jokes about The Office in the 50s and 60s, like the Mad Men era sort of thing, that a stenographer was one of the gals who'd, you know, she'd meet you over there by the carbon copies.
That's the only thing I can imagine, that there were a couple of stenographers who thought they were pregnant from their boss, but they really weren't.
Exactly.
That's the only thing that makes sense.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's funny.
It's making a lot of assumptions about stenographers.
But we laugh because it says stenographers, and that's just a funny word. But
it is.
You don't get the joke either, really.
Not really. No. I don't get it in terms of, that's why that's funny.
Yeah.
I get it in that it's funny like they said stenographer.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm just checking it out because, I found this old book in some bookstore downtown, and it was, you know, a joke book.
I love those old joke books. I have about 8 or 9 of them.
And it said, here's volume one of, you know, 3,972. I don't think the guy ever made the other 3,971. You know, and he drew a little picture of himself, and he asked for, you know, feedback and postcards in Pasadena and all that. But it was definitely from, like, the 40s.
Wow.
And this was one of the jokes. And, anyway.
Stenographer.
All right. I think that all people have some kind of a superpower.
Mm-hmm.
And by superpower, I mean something that just wants to come through you out into the world.
Mm-hmm.
It's an area of your life where you don't have to do any effort. It's just something natural. Do you have any sense of what that is for you?
Wow, that's a really good question.
Some quality or something for other people that just wants to...
I think it's compassion, oddly enough. People really seek me out and tell me their deepest, darkest secrets, things they want to confess. And let me tell you about...
Even when
you don't have. Let me tell you 5 stories from the past week of people who poured their hearts out. I'm just kidding. I'm not going to do that.
I was going to let you, but I was going to check out the first one and then go from there. But yeah.
No, but people tend to... They know that they've found like an ear for me. Like I'll have... You know, somebody who's like a homeless person who will stop by and like ask for money from everybody that comes by. And for me, they'll come up and they'll start telling me their story, or they'll come up and they'll need a hug, and I'm there for it. Fortunately, because I don't have any money to give them.
Yeah.
No, I usually, the thing is, if I sense somebody's really troubled,
sure,
I'll give them a buck or so.
No, I understand. Yeah. But this quality of people want to unburden themselves or be revealed to you.
Yeah.
When did you first notice, or how long has it been going on?
It's been going on, I think, since maybe high school or before that. I just, if you ask me if anything that I guess I do effortlessly, it's something that people look at me and assume that I'll be able to do or help them with, it's that.
Yeah. And do you have any, what's your experience of when this happens? I mean, do you feel somehow different than you do at other times?
I do. I feel kind of like a weird buzz that goes up my spine.
Yeah.
And like, I feel it in my head. It's the same thing I feel when I was a kid. I would feel this a lot. The feeling that I get when I watch a videotape of myself performing. It's
same
weird.
Kind of feeling.
Yeah, it's a buzz that happens near the base of my spine, comes out, and then it's a buzz that like hits the crown of my head and then stops it about a little bit before my eyebrows.
Yeah. No, it's radio. People won't get it. But
that's
why
I was describing all
when
that.
When you say the thing comes up your spine, you're with your hand, you're kind of having it flow over the top of your head and down the front of your face.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, so like all superpowers that...
It's like a spidey sense.
Well, you know, you don't necessarily ask for it.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's either bestowed upon you or you discover that you have it.
Yeah, because God knows, I didn't ask to hear everybody's sob stories.
No. But you also, I think, you must have had a choice at some point, even now, whether you're going to use this superpower for good or for evil.
Right.
Can you imagine what that might be?
Oh, if I'd start, like, blackmailing people?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah, that would be the easiest way.
Or you could become a con man and get people's confidence.
That's right? True, that's earn their confidence by listening to it. Yeah.
Right? Hmm. All right. Have you ever used it for evil, to your knowledge?
No.
Okay. All right. You seem like a nice guy.
Thank you.
So the superpower, using it
compassion.
For...
Compassion.
Yeah.
Using it for good.
Yeah. And I'm really buying it now because you get a physical sensation. Right?
Yeah.
Something is happening for you or in you, or and you're not necessarily trying to do it. It's a thing that comes.
That may be why I'm hooked on improv, is that like getting someone's trust feels good. you know, listening to somebody feels good.
Yeah.
And so maybe that's why I do it.
And then you don't have any compulsion afterwards to take advantage of them based on that information or to flim-flam them. Or, yeah. You just say, okay, have a nice day. Blackmail. All right. Well, yeah, if you really need money, I think blackmail might be a way to...
I'll have you take over the follow-up on that. And
I'm really good at follow-up.
All right.
Yeah, I'm really, you know,
I've noticed. Started,
Now, you have a somewhat quirky sleeping or bedtime ritual. What is it?
Well, I have a CPAP, which is a continuous positive air pressure. It's a breathing machine that people wear when they sleep. It almost looks like a flight mask. You know, you've seen the pilots that have that like a hose and the thing that covers their mouth.
Okay.
So I wear one of those. And so
makes you keep breathing.
Yeah.
That's useful.
So part of my sleep ritual is filling up the chamber. It has a humidifier chamber so that you don't get dry air up there. With distilled water, clicking it in place, and getting in bed. My wife usually goes to bed a little bit earlier than me because she works a 9-to-5 job.
And then you sleep with this mask.
Yeah.
Kind of like a Hannibal Lecter thing.
Yes, very much
so. She wakes up in the morning. Well, now she's used to it. But.
Yeah. Well, here was the thing. And I was doing this when I was dating and wasn't married and wasn't with somebody who would, you know, like, might be freaked out by the fact that, oh, by the way, I might stop sleeping and die if I don't wear this, which the risk of someone my age dying from sleep apnea is not that high, but still
it
could potentially exist. Yeah. So what I would do is I would go on a first date and keep the CPAP somewhere nearby. And so I would tell whomever I was with, and it would usually be after the third date, but I would always bring it along just in case. And say, like, hey, listen, I kind of usually sleep with this mask on that helps me. And they would be like, oh, those strips? I know. And I'm like, no. It's not the Breathe Right strips. It's a little bit more intense than that.
It's my own personal iron lung.
Yeah. I was like, if you're cool with that, I can bring it in. Or you could just see how you deal with me snoring. And when my wife and I first started dating, I gave her that option. And she heard me sleeping once and said, go get that thing. Get it now.
Well, that sounds like it must be a good test, right? If somebody's going to be freaked out about that or like, oh, that's weird. Then
yeah, because it is. It's freakier to deal with the sound of someone with sleep apnea, which is and then they stop breathing and then it'll pick up again. And I used to do that 97 times a night, according to my sleep study.
Wow. Like to have a moment where you stopped breathing and had to restart.
And now it happens 0.7 times a night, which means often not at all.
Well, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
97 to...
Yeah. Decimal, I also lost almost 100 pounds. I used to be almost 360 pounds. Wow. I'm now 264.
That helps too.
So, yeah. That's the big change.
Yeah. So that's a somewhat quirky sleeping or bedtime.
I would say so. Hook myself up to a machine. That's the quirky thing.
Any other jokes we can make about that? I mean, can we bring a little more humor out of it?
I never breathe easy when I sleep.
Okay.
That's a lame joke.
That's a lame joke.
Yeah.
You just make that up?
Yeah.
Good, because it's terrible.
Yeah. If I had written that down and said, in case anybody ever asked me what my nighttime sleeping ritual is,
I'm glad. This singer. Right. You're allowed to come
unleash.
Up with...
Maybe I could tie it into an old Amos and Andy joke. I'm sure we'll be talking about Amos and Andy. It's radio.
You're allowed to come up with goofy, stupid jokes on the fly, but not to repeat them later.
Totally.
Now, have you listened to any episodes of this show? I'm just wondering if you did.
I was wanting to before I got in here because my good friend Jason Murphy had just been on your podcast.
Yeah, he was great.
And I wasn't able to. I wanted to listen to that beforehand so I could find out what I was coming in for today.
Well, it's better that you didn't.
I think so, too. I would rather be surprised.
I imagine that afterwards you'll listen.
Yes. Like
when you're on the show, you'll probably listen.
I probably will. Probably. I know I'll share the hell out
you'll
of it.
Probably listen. Maybe not.
No, I will. I'm so self-absorbed. I will listen to every minute of it. I will wonder what you cut out. I'll lose a night's sleep with a mask about it.
That's not true.
I'm not.
You're not that self-absorbed.
No, not at all.
Regular listeners to this show, which there may be a few, know that I have a thing personally about pie.
Oh, yeah.
I have a thing about pie. Somewhere over 20 years ago, I was walking around and I was asking myself a serious question. Like, what can I, one little guy, really do to help make the world a better place to bring love and joy into the hearts of people I care about? Mm-hmm. And I got like a lightning bolt from some unknown place that said, you could give permission to your family and friends to hit you in the face with a pie or squirt seltzer anytime.
Oh, wow.
And when I first got this message, of course, I said no. But then I instantly realized that this was the right thing to do. So over the past 20-something years, I've been hit in the face with pies dozens of times. Mm-hmm. The question is this. You're going to do this. You are going to give permission mm-hmm. to someone to hit you in the face with a pie
mm-hmm.
or a squirt seltzer. And this person could be anybody living or dead through history, anybody you want. Who would be the ideal person?
I would say Mo Howard, without hesitation.
From the Three Stooges.
Yes.
Yeah, no hesitation.
Do you know he was an expert at throwing pies?
I've heard that.
Yeah, his vaudeville act, part of it consisted of him being able to be like, I'm sure you've, you know, if this is your passion.
My milieu.
Yeah. He could, with deadly accuracy, hit a person in the face with a pie, which is why they especially used a lot of pie fights in Three Stooges because he could. And a lot of times he would be the person off camera throwing it when somebody else was throwing it at somebody. They'd do the turnaround and see, you know, who was getting hit. And they would figure they'd waste less of the project's money if he was the one throwing them because it would always hit the person in the face.
Now, what do you know about his accuracy? I mean, how far or what, you know, how did he...
I don't know from how far away or how small of a range he would have to have, but... That was kind of his calling card.
He was famous for long-distance pie accuracy.
Yeah, so I would want someone who's accurate.
Okay.
And do you ever notice it's funnier when it's like a blackberry pie than when it's like a custard cream?
Why do you think so?
Because it comes in two phases. It hits the person, and it's a little bit heavier, yeah. I think. And they wipe away... The white cream,
yeah.
And then there's the black underneath it.
Now that you mention Three Stooges, and I've seen that particular effect
yes!
many times.
And that's why I think...
The one where they're the exterminators?
Yes!
That's a classic.
Yeah.
That's a classic pie fight.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but you're right. That one especially, there's black underneath. And So we think it's blackberry because it was a black and white thing. It could have been anything.
Yeah, it's true. It could have been... What else could have been? It could have been cherry.
Well, it could have been, you know, anything that showed up darker than the white stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah, I never really thought about it, but now that you say it.
Yeah. This is an odd branch of the conversation because I thought you were going to tell me, I love all kinds of pies, and what's your favorite kind of pie? It became this awesome pie-throwing conversation.
Well, I mean, you know, that's an interesting topic.
Yeah.
It doesn't fit on this show.
Not at all.
It's outside the purview of what kind of pie you like or anything.
Yeah.
We don't really care.
Bless you for that.
Mo Howard is going to... And so what else do you imagine if he's going to... If you and he are going to have this moment,
mm-hmm.
anything around the setting? What do you... Now that we're into it, what do you see?
I would have to be in a tuxedo,
uh-huh.
A chandelier on a table in front of me. Maybe one of those silver dishes that, you know, you raise up and something's underneath it. But like
a chafing dish.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But one of those personal ones, like they did, you know, like a chafing dish is like for everyone, right?
Yes.
But there's like they don't in those old shows they'd put it in front of them and they'd lift it up and there'd be like a half dead bird under there,
got
something
it.
Like that.
So
the pie would hit me. I'd be like, "Why you?" And I'd lift it up and be like, "Ha!" And my eyes would bug out and my mouth would drop open.
Before the pie or after the pie?
They'll be after the pie.
After the pie.
Yeah.
All right. So we need to.
And of course, I'd have to taste the pie.
Yeah.
You know.
No, because they do that.
And comment on it and go. Blackberry.
Yeah.
Or something
that. And would he say anything or would you say anything to him? Because it's pretty an intimate thing to then give permission and to be hit in the face with a pie this way. Because it's not going to be a surprise.
I would hope something reassuring. Like, listen, Pinhead, you'll enjoy it. Something like that.
That sounds reassuring.
Yeah.
He's going to call you Pinhead.
I guess so.
Yeah.
I can't imagine him saying, here you go, dear. It would have to be something like that or call me a cretin or something.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, he probably did that.
Yeah.
That, when they're the exterminators,
mm-hmm.
My favorite moment that I just have remembered my whole life, I think Curly, maybe it's Larry, he's got like a pocket full of silverware and stuff, and he's got a pie in his hand, and Mo says, put that pie down, and he hits it, and it goes and it sticks in the ceiling,
mm-hmm.
and Larry walks away, and Mo is there standing under the pie, and the woman comes up to him.
Mm-hmm.
And starts talking to him and asking him a bunch of questions. And he keeps looking up at the ceiling. And the pie is slowly starting to fall.
Yes.
And she says, young man, you look as if you have the sword of Damocles hanging over your head.
And he says, "Lady, you must be psychic." And he runs off and she looks up and that pie hits her in the face. That's how the pie fight starts.
Yeah.
And then she does that. She wipes it off her eye and she flings it off.
Mm-hmm.
And then it hits somebody else.
Yeah.
And that's how that begins.
That's like Hitchcock meets Ted Healy.
People think the Three Stooges and Bugs Bunny and Mad Magazine, those were my three influences. They think they're for kids and stuff, but as a kid, I understood that those were all parodies of adult stuff. And even though I didn't know the adult stuff, it made me curious.
And even like the original, the Tales Calculated to Drive You Mad, the old comic books, those were way more adult than anything later on.
Yeah, yeah.
They were so dark, like the Archie's Comics one.
Yeah.
Holy crap.
So here I am, 10 years old, saying, what is the Sword of Damocles?
Right.
And I'm going, you know, looking up the Sword of Damocles because it's in Three Stooges.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway. Now, we're almost out of time. How much time do we have? Oh, gosh. 5 minutes left. Where can we see you? Is there some place that we can see you coming up? You have any things you want to announce?
You can see me all the time at Comedy Sports at the El Portal Theater. Mm-hmm. If you want to know which nights I'm playing, you can go to theimprovtrick.com and look at the Bill Cott page, and it'll show you all the different my monthly calendar, all the different shows I'm doing, like the Magic Show of Christ the King, like the Lucy Fest, and all those other things. So anybody wants to find out where I'm appearing, when I'm appearing, they can go to theimprovtrick.com. They could also go to my website, mailman.blog.
Okay.
It's a WordPress website where I just put up information about what's up next for me.
Okay. And again, Cott is C-H-O-T-T.
C-H-O-T-T. They can also connect with me on Twitter, at Bill Cott.
Yes. All right. Now back to our show. We always like to do that stuff. That's always
absolutely
good. The last thing I do on this show is I like to anagram. Stuff, right? An anagram is when I take the letters of a word or phrase and just rearrange them and see what other things you can get.
Yeah.
So sometimes the thing you get is really kind of cool, and sometimes it doesn't make any difference at all. But I'm going to show you some stuff that I anagrammed. So first, I anagrammed just your name, and this is one thing that was interesting. Will you read that?
Yeah, Bill Cott, Bitch Toll.
Bitch Toll.
That's nice.
Now, the game as an improviser is, can we justify this? Does that ring a bell for you?
Does that ring a bell for me?
Is this you, Bill Cott, or Toll Bitch?
Probably Toll Bitch. I've done a lot of driving. I do a lot of, so now, if you put it the other way, much more. Because the bitch toll, I've never paid a bitch toll.
Okay.
Unless, I guess lawyer's fees for my first marriage. Yeah, that's stretching. But a toll bitch, I do a lot of driving, and it's a lot of it winds up going through Oklahoma where there's like, you know, you wind up paying five different tolls across the same highway. And it's like, come on, it's the same highway, guys.
Texas also is.
Yeah, Texas is that too.
All right, so toll bitch, that might be you.
Definitely.
Of course, there was a bunch of other things that didn't seem entertaining or sensible in any way. I just cut those all out.
You'd be surprised because I love this one.
William
Cott. Yeah, my official legal name. Two Chili Malt.
I thought that might be you somehow.
It really is, and I'll tell you why. My first, the first job that I really enjoyed that I did when I was younger was working at Steak and Shake. I kind of, before I graduated high school, I worked at a Steak and Shake. And for those who aren't familiar with Steak and Shake, it's becoming more of a national brand.
It's an Italian restaurant that serves only personal pan pizzas. Mwah. Yeah, Steak and Shake.
No, but they have old-fashioned soda jerks who like mix up the sodas and mix up the shakes and everything like that. And I was a soda jerk at the Steak and Shake near Northwest Plaza in St. Louis.
So two chili malt.
And I love their chili. Yeah.
William Cott. Two chili malt.
Were there any others? Can you see?
Well, not that rang a bell for me.
So okay.
Maybe. You can go home and anagram things and search around.
I'm bad at that.
Here's the next one. Herschel
Lariat
Tate. How do you say his name?
Larry Tate.
Larry Tate. It's a weird name.
It's a play off the character in Bewitched of Larry Tate.
Oh. There
was also a play on that character from I Dream of Jeannie, you know, the Dr. Bellows.
Dr. Bellows.
So there was I'm sorry, Major Healy.
Major Healy
was his character. Although it would have been funny if it was Bellows. But anyway, the art teacher on Wizards of Waverly Place was named Mrs. Major Healy.
I see.
All right. So
that was the joke there.
Anyway,
so
this Herschel was your Larry character's Tate. Name, Herschel Larry Tate. So one thing in anagrams to this is healthier alerts.
Yeah.
I figured if you're the principal of the school, mm-hmm. you're probably advocating for healthy stuff for your students.
I am. Well, and actually, I've been advocating for healthy eating for a while in my own life. Like I said, I lost a bunch of weight.
100 pounds.
So, yeah. So using not Fitbit. What is the – there's a program on my phone that I used to use all the time. No.
Not a taser?
No, it's not. The taser would help. A taser on my fridge. Yes.
Yeah.
It's a program that reminds you to log all the things that you eat. Oh, yeah. And then if you work out and, you know, you weigh yourself in and your friends can say, hey, good going. So that's a healthy alert.
All right.
Right there.
All right. So we've justified it, but not in a way that was really humorous or weird.
Anyway, yeah.
It's pretty sensible.
Yeah.
All right. It's not my favorite, but it's okay.
Right. The other one, hire halal tester.
Yeah. What about that one?
Well, I love Mediterranean food.
Yes.
I don't think I've eaten anything that's strictly halal.
Really?
Yeah.
Because there are some restaurants around where it's getting more popular, the halal guys,
yeah.
the chain, and, you know, because it's like kosher. When you kill yeah. the animal, there are some strictures and things
yeah.
you have to do.
So I've got a feeling sooner or later I will, but I would love to hire someone to go out and test it and find the very best halal.
That's right.
So that I can have some great Middle Eastern food.
Again, as the principal of a school, you might have a need to hire a halal tester.
True.
In a future episode, although it's off the air now.
Yeah, sadly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What I like about these shows, like these Disney shows, is that like the middle school kids, they're normal.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the adults who are all goofy and wacky. And
yeah.
that reflects the way kids see the world. Like,
right.
we're the ones who are fine. We don't know what the hell is going on with these crazy grown-up people.
Yeah.
And the healthy laugh track.
Yes.
Oh, my God.
You'd be surprised how much of that is actual studio audience laughter, though. Although a lot of the scenes that were done with special effects
yeah.
are shot without an audience because
sure.
they'd shoot it the day before.
Sure.
But I'm always surprised, and I hope I'm not like talking down to studio audiences, but the things that get laughs in front of a studio audience that I look at and I'm like, yeah, I can see where this is funny, but I wouldn't laugh out loud at it,
right.
that a studio audience just dies.
Well, I would imagine when you record this show,
mm-hmm.
you know, you have a bunch of middle school kids who love the show and
yeah.
love the characters. And, yeah, why the heck? Yeah.
So they see me splattered with paint, they're going to love it.
Yeah. Now, I also anagrammed the improv trick.
Yes.
And read this first one.
Hick TV importer.
I got here like some kind of West Virginia Appalachian guy who's
mm-hmm.
importing televisions from some foreign country, and that's as far as I got.
Yeah, I would think that I import hicks to do TV.
So, play that. So, what are you seeing?
Like, you know, when I did improv trick back in St. Louis, and I'm
yeah.
not calling all my good friends back in St. Louis
I
hicks.
Understand.
But they're certainly not
can
cosmopolitans.
I call them Hicks? Yeah, no, I can't.
I will punch you
okay.
if you call right. my friends
Hicks. Just want to know where the lines are.
You should
drawn.
Call them Hoosiers. If you're
Hoosiers.
From St. Louis,
yeah.
that means completely different. In
totally.
Indiana, a Hoosier means somebody who's from Indiana.
Right.
In St. Louis, a Hoosier is like trailer trash.
Like a hoser.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, that's good. Yeah. Wait, is Missouri right next to Indiana?
Well, no, we got Illinois between us.
Oh, Illinois. Okay, got it.
Yeah.
It would just be interesting if what. One side of the border called themselves was good
yeah.
and right across the street.
I think it might have happened that there was a bunch of itinerant laborers from Indiana who were coming into St. Louis and
yeah.
settled like in the south side of the city. So that's why
yeah.
It's more of like a south side St. Louis thing.
Yeah.
But then it became like all over.
Okay.
No matter
so
where you're from in St. Louis. You
anyway,
you're
so,
a Hoosier. That's a Hoosier bar.
Hick TV importer. So you see
yeah.
some Hoosiers. And what's the – I'm confused. What's the image now?
That I'm helping – Hicks get into TV.
Helping
if I'm trying to personalize it and saying, like, how does this have to do with me?
Well, we just have to justify
about the improv trick. I've helped a lot of people go into TV.
So you've helped them move from being Hicks up into being more cosmopolitan, successful.
Transvestites.
Yeah,
yes.
Transvestites.
So.
Oh, you went TV transvestite. Now I like it more. Now I like it more. Okay.
Hey, y'all, I got some folks that they identify either way, and I'm bringing them in the country.
I'm okay with that. And,
yeah.
You know, the Hick could also, it could be a Hick TV.
Yeah.
And then I saw kind of like a Barney Rubble TV that you're importing that, you know,
yeah.
has a
squirrel inside that's running, and that's how you see the evening news. All right, that doesn't work. Now, this next one, the improv trick anagrams to this.
Chirp, trek, vomit.
I had no idea what those three words meant together, but I just figured, wow, they were I got so nothing out of chirp, trek, vomit.
Well, if you knew a little bit more about me, and if you had done better research, you would know that I have a really bad gag reflex. Tina Fey spoke about it on the David Letterman show once. And
by very bad, you mean very active.
Yes.
Okay.
So sometimes the smell of something can trigger my vomit. Like one time when we were touring, we were in, I think it was either Greeley or Rangeley in Colorado, and there was a rendering plant. And so it wasn't.
They boil down fat and waste products
and
from
it
butchering.
Stinks.
Yeah.
And we smelled how bad the town was when we arrived. But what we didn't know is after dark, nobody goes out at night, except for when there's a special performance like us in town performing at the theater. And so that's when they crank up the rendering, and so it stinks all night. So as people are in their homes, they got air conditioning on or whatever, they're not going to smell it. But if you step outside, you certainly will. So we stepped outside for a cigarette break at intermission, and I took one deep inhale, and then, pardon me, folks at home, projectile, hope nobody's eating lunch listening to this, projectile vomited on the steps. I've been captured on videotape in Chicago for a show that we did once.
Vomiting.
Where, I had, all they had for us in the green room was Cheetos and orange soda. And I felt a vomit coming up.
Everything orange, yeah.
I felt a vomit coming up and I tried to cover my mouth with my
Cheetos.
Hand.
Yeah.
And the vomit went into my hand and sprayed out of from between my knuckles. So there was like a five-part stream hitting the audience of orange vomit. I would say a chirp trek vomit. Trek, of course, we could make a Galaxy Quest connection there.
Mm-hmm.
And chirp, I do spend a lot of time on Twitter. So chirp trek vomit.
I'm not even interested in the other words. You had a couple of good stories about puking your vomit. That's good enough for me.
Totally.
Okay, here's the last thing. Now, you were a fraternity brother.
Yes, I was.
Now, this first word, C-H-I, is that?
Chi,
like caught.
Yes,
same thing. It's
exactly.
C-H that is pronounced. I'm just checking. So it's Chi Delta was your fraternity.
It was very different than when we think of fraternities, we think of the bros and the keg parties and stuff. There were four members when I pledged, and there was a four-man pledge class. And they were like, we were like the outcasts on campus. Like, the president of the fraternity was one of the few theater majors in the small Christian campus, and he was the only out gay man on campus. And the pledge class.
He was really unpopular.
No, he was really popular, you know. But in terms of being able to come out of the closet in a small Christian campus, tough to do.
Yeah.
He had some balls, so to speak.
Yeah. I don't think
Jimmy
I could
John.
Do that. I mean, no, it takes a lot of guts.
Yeah.
It really does.
Yeah. And it wasn't like people were small-minded and were like that, but it was definitely, I would say it was definitely tougher in 1988. For a gay man to come out in Missouri.
Yeah. Even now.
Yeah.
Well, so here, this is good because I thought I got four things out of this.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, Chi Delta, it's the kind of fraternity you were either this one, or this one.
Okay.
And so read the first one.
This is interesting.
Read the first
one. So a lithe cad.
Lithe cad.
Now,
that's
I know.
It's kind of like an aristocratic. You know, there's that fraternity on town where everyone's kind of rich and cool. And
is that what lithe means, are we taking that interpretation of cad to say that too?
Well, lithe is.
I thought that meant skinny.
Yeah, but it also could mean graceful. You know, skinny and great, like the bad
guys. I would say neither of those words would definitely describe
the bad guys in the ski movie. You know, where it's like the nerds go skiing and then they're the bad people. You know, it's like the Revenge of the Nerds. So the lithe cads are like the good-looking, wealthy. Yeah, but that was not your.
Yeah.
That was not
Eat
your
Child family. Would also probably not be. Idle Chat,
wait. Don't skip past.
I'm not skipping because I'm ending child. On the punchline.
Don't skip past Eat Child. That's also not your fraternity.
Yeah, you didn't, definitely not.
No,
we ate no children.
Didn't eat.
No cannibalization.
No, okay. All right. So that's so you're not not the live cad fraternity. And you're
certainly
not the Eat Child fraternity either.
Idle Chat, potential, because we would sit around the lunch table. Mm-hmm. Because she really didn't have fraternity houses there.
Right, okay.
So we would all sit around the same lunch table. That was one of the things that unified us. And we would talk about any crazy bull that came into our heads. sometimes political chit-chat, sometimes gossip, but we would always have the dumbest conversations that would end in really stupid arguments. Like Marty Kirkland, one of the guys that I knew, he took a fork and he had a balled up napkin, lit it on fire and flicked it at me, just because I was defending some girl's honor.
Good times. Good times,
Bill. Like you said, the devil was going to come do something to this girl. Anyway.
I like the religious people that are determined.
He was not religious, though.
The devil's going to come at you because you are so messed up. I mean.
Here was the thing is Marty was also a Kaidel, and he was Wiccan, and he would destroy Satanist temples. So when I talk about the devil. And see, that's how you become an outcast at a Christian campus.
Well, that's like
you're either gay or Wiccan or a theater major. Yeah, I don't understand log cabin Republicans at all.
No, but if you're the Christian that is destroying Wiccan thing, I mean, basically But the one that seems to fit is which one?
Laced Hit.
Is that you? Is with that you guys?
Not me, but the group. See, we were known for something called Mother Punch Hunch. Okay. Mother Hunch Punch, rather.
That makes more sense.
And that was a punch that had – nobody knew what was in it.
Right.
And back in the 70s, when it was more of a rugby fraternity and they were like really nuts and like there was like acid, you know, LSD in greater supply, they dosed an entire thing of that. And they said there was a trail of bodies leading back from where they had the party out by the lake all the way back to campus. People just like passed out.
Laying down.
Laying down, enjoying the – the moonlight, and in the next morning, the sun. So I would say laced hit. Although we never did anything like that. We certainly never put any drugs in. We put a lot of grain alcohol, a lot of vodka, a lot of other booze in that secret mixture. But
I'm glad we got one of these. So Chi Delta, you're not the Lithe Cad fraternity. You're not.
That would have been the Sig Alphs.
Eat Child. But see, you know who those are. Idle Chat, maybe. But Laced Hit.
Yes.
See? Yeah, all right. That's the type for you guys.
Yeah.
That's the reputation you had to outlive on college.
Yeah, because people like alumni and like especially most of the people who were in the administration there at the college were alumni of the place. So every time they heard Chi Delta, they would worry about what we were up to, even though we were like the most innocent, nerdy guys on campus.
But you weren't always. Might not be now. Do you ever go back there?
Definitely.
And, you know, like knock on the door and say, oh, yeah.
My wife, that's how I met my wife. She's much younger than me. She was the fraternity sweetheart. She wasn't when I met her, but she later became the sweetheart. I went back there. She was a returning student, so it wasn't like I was really, you know, cradle robbing.
Clean it up, yeah.
She had worked in politics for a while and decided to go back to college and get a degree in religion. And so I was back for a party, and her sorority she was in is kind of a little bit different than most sororities when you think of those, you know, they're not like...
They eat kids. Her sorority
There you
kids.
Go.
Yeah. And somebody ate kids.
Yeah, that's the only reason why my wife had one was so that she could eat one.
I heard that there's a difference when you eat your own versus eating someone else's. It's just a really different experience.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you can adopt one and eat it.
But much tenderer.
Eat your own.
More sweet.
Yeah, that's what I heard. Well, I would like to thank my guest, the only monosaturated Bill Cott, for coming in this week. If you'd like to buy a Comedy Death Star coffee mug, you can email me at comedydeathstar@acsdigital.tv. How about a testimonial? You've been drinking from this Comedy Death Star coffee mug all show.
First of all, it cleans up really well.
Yeah, that's
it's good. Not obtrusive because I didn't know that it was a Comedy Death Star mug. I didn't notice it.
Really?
Oh, I know. Yeah, I don't look at mugs.
I handed it to you. You've been drinking from
you
it.
You did. Well, see, I'm looking down at this part of it, which is all white because it has water in it. And so I'm looking down.
I see.
And trying to maintain that all-important eye contact with you.
I see, because you're listening. So what I'm hearing is for like some better branding, maybe I should get the design on the inside of the mug.
That would be cool. But like I said, it's not obtrusive. So unless somebody buys it to say like, hey, I'm a big fan of Comedy Death Star, and that's the best way to support the show, is buy three of them in case one of them breaks. So they'll always have two for them and a great friend while they sit down and listen to the podcast.
I'm curious now that you think you need three in case one breaks. What if you just want to have a threesome? What if you have two lovers?
Why would you do that?
Well, why would you automatically not consider? You think it's more likely that you're going to break one?
It's more intimate to sit down. See, they can almost mimic the experience we're having here.
Almost.
Which is sitting across the table from one another.
Yeah.
You can't sit across the table from two another.
Really?
one another. It's a phrase.
We're going to have to talk about architecture and furniture design. I'm distracted that you said the cup is unobtrusive. It's supposed to be shameless self-promotion. And that's not being unobtrusive when the goal of it is to do shameless self-promotion. I'm off-brand, Bill.
No, not at all.
You like it?
It looks classy, yeah.
Okay. If you'd like to buy a Comedy Death Star coffee mug, email me at comedydeathstar@acsdigital.tv. Our theme music was written and performed by Dean Mermill. You've been listening to Comedy Death Star, the official podcast of Actors Comedy Studio, right here in Hollywood, USA. I'm your host, Denzel Myers. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week. Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.